session number 30304.
Ted Rayner, Reel 1. Ted, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in Newchurch in Rossendale, which is in Lancashire, on the 4th of February 1920.
What did your father do for a living, Ted?
Well, he worked in a slipper factory, but he died when I was 4, so I have very, very few memories of him, and that's about all I can say. I know from what other people have said that he was a fine man, and he'd had some problems during the First World War which stayed with him and perhaps contributed to his early death. But that left my mother as a widow with just myself, her only son.
What are the experiences your father had that had caused the problems during the First World War?
I'm not sure.
What about the family home? What was that like?
It was very small, a cottage on a street, cobbled street, off a steep hill, which was an alternative to going, an alternative route to going to Rawtenstall, which was the major town in the area, about 3 miles away. We had one room downstairs with a small kitchen and a cellar in which there was a spring and at one time had been a supply of water for the household because they were quite old buildings in Pennine stone. And two bedrooms with an outside toilet.
What about your early education?
Sorry?
Your early education.
I went to the local elementary school, as it was known as in those days. I got the scholarship all right and moved on to the local Bacup and Rawtenstall Grammar School, which was actually situated in Waterfoot, which was virtually a village in which I lived. And from there I took the usual, forget the name of the examinations now. School certificate. To credit level in about half a dozen subjects, and then because there was a need for money for the household, I left at the age of 16 and entered a competitive examination for a post in the Borough Treasurer's Department at Rawtenstall, which fortunately I got. Stayed with them a year and then transferred to Martin's Bank. Worked in Bury in Lancashire and was with them until the outbreak of war.
Given your wartime career, did you have in the 1930s an interest in aviation?
Oh, yes. I was going to carry on there with that. It had been my preferred choice of career, very much so, and I used to take the aeroplane and flight magazines, and I was very much up to date, and fortunately I was a member of a local non-denominational church, and we had a very strong social side, which included discussions on a Sunday afternoon during the Sunday school, the afternoon session, where we had some very long and interesting discussions about the future that was beginning to present itself as something we were going to have to deal with. which of course in due course came along as more or less we'd forecast. There were some ridiculous things we said and did, of course. I remember one chap who said that the Queen Mary, which the first of the large Cunard liners, of course, was only a battleship in disguise, and that kind of thing. But yes, I wasn't very interested in the job I was doing. I did it, I think, fairly proficiently, but it wouldn't have been my choice, but I had to think of other things.
And there was awareness amongst you and your peers of the situation in Europe at the time?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, very much so. We were all expecting by 38, when the disappointment of Munich showed that there was only one way we could go, really. There was great discussion about the fact that we could all expect to be conscripted when we knew it was going to be brought in by, I think it was March 1939. That enabled me to say to my mother, well, I'm sorry, but I'm obviously going to have to go anyway, so could I please join the Volunteer Reserve, which of course had begun to try to enroll people, boys interested, in the RAF, and that's how I got into aviation.
How had you heard of the Volunteer Reserve?
There were advertisements in the papers, I think. But in any case, certainly in the magazines, in Aeroplane and Flight, they were very well presented and very informative. I kept up to date with Britain First. That was through the magnanimity of the Daily Express, I think. Shall we say, fostering financially as well as publicly the production of what became the Blenheim, and that kind of thing, of course, was all very encouraging to someone who wanted to get in an aircraft and fly. And then, of course, as you may have read, the first time I did fly was when I took a holiday just before my medical for entry to the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve, from a holiday in Jersey back to Southampton in what was then known as an airliner. It was just about a dozen seats in a de Havilland, I forget the original name of it, but strange thing, and I loved it. I loved it at 4,000 feet, and I thought, this is it, this is me. And I was later able to fly one when I was on the staff at HQCC.
Was it the Dragon Rapide?
Rapide, yeah.
Did that first flight live up to your expectations for all the material that you'd read about?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, obviously, it was a straight and level flight, you know. I mean, the takeoff and the landing. I had a seat from which I could see some of the things happening in the cockpit. And that all added to it, of course.
How did you go about joining the Volunteer Reserve?
Well, there was a form to fill in, but that's about all I remember. Once I'd passed my medical, Rossendale, where I lived, was about 20 miles north of Manchester, and the town centre from which RAF VR units worked, to far as theory of flying and that kind of thing, administration, and drill. That took place in a city centre, and there would be a local airfield, which was Barton, for us in Manchester. So I had to go down for this medical. I passed the necessary educational tests, and so far as I remember, that was all there was to it.
Can you remember what type of things they were actually asking for the educational tests? What kind of standard you had to be at?
Well, I would say I can't give any examples of the actual questions or theories or anything of that kind, but I would say that the standards expected were those which one would get with a grammar school education up to the level of school certificate. And I think that would be borne out by the fact that I had a younger cousin who went to what in the Rossendale Valley anyway was known as a central secondary school, and it was an attempt by the education authorities to provide perhaps more of a technical education, more in keeping with the 1944 Act, so that you had an ordinary secondary school and a technical and a grammar school. And he didn't manage to get the scholarship, but he went to this central secondary school and managed to get equivalent qualifications, I imagine, to those which I had to enter the RAF. It wouldn't be the RAF in VR in his case, in the same sense as in mine, because people, chaps who actually joined the RAF after war had begun, went in to what was the VR element, but not pre-war VR, if you see what the distinction is. So everybody who joined the RAF after the war began was entitled to put the little VR in the lapels. But it didn't mean quite the same thing.
Medically, what were they, again, looking for medically? Was there anything that was obvious while you were having your medical?
Well, no. I mean, I didn't have much knowledge of what the various parts of the human body should operate at what level then. I don't think I'd ever had my... I had been in hospital when I was 12, but I don't remember much about that. Whether they took my blood pressure then or not, I don't know, but that sort of thing, I don't remember ever having that the need for that. So I can't say any more.
I was just thinking, was it just like general eyes, ears, hands,
coordination? Oh, yes, sort of yes. Thing? Oh, in terms of coordination, I remember we had to walk along a line drawn on the floor and with various weights in one hand and then in the other, and then try to do it blindfold. Obviously something to do with balance and lifting the weights of various things, I think there were pepper pots, to assess the proportion of weight in one compared with another and so on. I take that as something to do with the pressure you need on forward and backward movement or that kind of thing. The general testing of muscles in a very almost amateurish way, in bending the arm and so on, and turning the head and touching your toes that kind of almost Swedish exercises.
Can you describe to me a little bit more, Ted, how the town centres for the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve worked? What was based there and what and how that operated countrywide?
I can't say countrywide. I only know of the one in Manchester, but certainly the others were similar because of chat between chaps from other who had been with other units when we all met up at the beginning of the war, and we went to Cambridge ITW, Initial Training Wing. All this, of course, would be covered in our conversation because I couldn't think of much else to talk about, I suppose. Really, we had to sympathise with the people who were lecturing to us or administering because we were such a varied bunch. I don't know what the catchment area of Manchester VR Centre would be, but obviously, I mean, having met lads from Oldham down to places on the west side, Stockport and so on, all with having been to different educational establishments and from different with different backgrounds, we were as generous as we could be to the lecturers and the usually sergeants or corporals actually doing the hard grind. We were, of course, supposed to have a uniform, which we didn't get before the war. We were known as the sports jacket and flannels brigade. That was the usual get-up. I mean, this is another thing which is so different today, that you look almost formally dressed if you're wearing a jacket as such. And it was the usual turnout. We learned a lot, not only about the basics of flying, and I mean the very basics, you know, not even at initial training standard, but where, for instance, flying was being developed and how and why, for various reasons. I mean, America would come into the picture. Because they were, well, they had much more opportunity to use aircraft to cover their vast distances and so on. So I say what we learned at ITW, at the VR centres, would be very general. But the great thing was that it brought us together and got us into the belief that this was an organisation worth joining, and we wanted to join.
You said your instructors, were they regular RAF NCOs?
Yes, the NCOs were. We had, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there were some, very few, I don't think of more than two or three, who had joined the centre as soon as it opened. And they, whether they'd had private flying experience as well, I don't know, but they had their wings up. And there was one sergeant I remember quite well. But he wasn't really on the permanent staff of the town centre. I think he was perhaps a liaison between the town centre and the flying centre.
Were there any civilian instructors at all that you used at that stage?
Oh, yes, there were civilian instructors. And Some of them, I imagine, from the depth of your knowledge, came from volunteer, presumably from the university. Obviously, any CO of a town centre like that in a place like Manchester would make the most of the local facilities, educational as well as otherwise. And there were people by that time, because don't remember, we knew by this time. I mean, please do remember. I said don't remember. Please do remember by that time. We all knew there was going to be a war. This was only 3 months before war broke out. So it was a bringing together of people, and well worth it for that virtue alone.
How often did you have to attend? Because obviously you'd have to make the journey down to Manchester, but how often did you do that in a week?
Only once a week. I probably didn't have more than four or five, Saturday morning as well, or Sunday. If we were, I think I'm right in saying that we flew on alternate Sundays, and I think on the other Sunday, if we weren't flying, we would be expected to attend at the town centre. And perhaps have the Saturday off. I'm not sure about that.
And would you attend one night in the week as well?
Oh yes.
And how long?
When it was possible. For me, it wasn't easy because until I managed to get a little car, one of the 1937 model Morris 8s, lovely little car it was. Lasted until 1950, I remember, and I'd had it at one or two RAS stations as well during that period. Anyway, I had this car eventually, having persuaded my parents and my guardian to let me draw upon the small fund which had accumulated. I like to think through thrift and grift, and gift rather. But before that, it was difficult. I could get down to the town centre, of course, by train, although it wasn't always easy getting back afterwards, because the last train, on some occasions, dumped me on the station at Waterfoot with another half an hour to go to walk home from there. I couldn't get down to the flying centre, to Barton, until I got this small car, which, of course, the RAF, in a way, helped me to run, because I wouldn't have been able to get the car if I hadn't joined the VR.
What was the first experience you had of flying?
Apart from the one I've already described.
Yeah, I mean with the volunteer reserve.
Oh, yes. The first experience was quite an experience. Because we'd got rather... I think I'd been down to the airfield twice without any luck, because there were so many of us in terms of the proportion of would-be flyers with the instructors. I don't know what the ratio was. It was certainly getting on between 1 in 10 or something like that. So although it wasn't a waste of time, very few of us were able to fly on the first visit or even the second. And it was my third visit, I think, when we were a small group of us sitting around and beginning to grumble in rather doubtful terms. Almost aggressive terms. about this waste of time just sitting around doing nothing when I was presenting the spiel, as it were, a flying instructor, a civilian, of course, came past and told me to... obviously, I tried to make it look as though I was only expressing the opinion of the gathering, but anyway, he picked on me and said, go and get yourself a parachute and your helmet, and so on. And then come meet me at aircraft A for horses, which I thought, oh, that's a bit of a joke, perhaps it's not so bad. And so we took off and went up, and before long I was... it was a rather cloudy day with spots of sunshine piercing the gloom. And I noticed that we were approaching the Manchester Ship Canal, which is a wonderful landmark, of course, for navigation. And there was quite a big ship, it seemed to me, on it, and we were flying towards it. And I thought, oh, we're going to go and give it a wing waggle, or at least that sort of thing. And then suddenly I found myself upside down in the aircraft, and I noticed that, very quickly noticed, one of the straps was sliding off my shoulder, and I had various thoughts about preferring to continue to be able to take in O2 rather than H2O, because it looked as though I was going to find myself deposited in the ship canal, and it's just as though we were hung there over this ship, and the belt started slipping off the other shoulder, and so I put my right hand, and remember this very well, put my right hand across to try and pull the left hand strap up onto my shoulder, when fortunately the aircraft did another half roll as I was very soon to know what a roll was, so that we were back on course, and he simply flew back to the aerodrome and pulled off a beautiful landing, for which I was very grateful, he said something like, well, now, Rainer, you've got an idea that you will find that in the RAF you'll have quite a bit of waiting to do, rather than thinking you can fly yourself off and do a dawn patrol like Mick Manock. So I took that to be my punishment for the rather irreverent words I'd used about the delay.
What was the aerodrome like at Barton?
I don't think I can remember this very well. It's rather strange, isn't it, that the things that you do remember well have a very personal connection with you, whereas to me at that stage, any level green patch of sward was a suitable aerodrome, and that's more or less what it looked like. I remember we were near Chat Moss, and the original line of the railway between Manchester and Liverpool, there was a sort of almost, I suppose we would call today, a prefabricated building, which was the mess for when we had the opportunity to use it. That's about all I can remember.